Our second reading today is from Acts. This is the New Revised Standard Translation of the Bible. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was deeply distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he argued in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons, and also in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Also, some Epicurean and Stoic philosophers debated with him. Some said, "Why does this babbler want to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a good proclaimer of foreign divinities." This was because he was telling the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. So they took him and brought him to the Areopagus and asked him, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? It sounds rather strange to us, so we would like to know what it means." Now all the Athenians and the foreigners living there would spend their time in nothing but telling or hearing something new. Here ends the reading.
The Apostle Paul was disturbed. And he was disturbed by the fact that he had had a hard time in Ephesus, run out of town, because he dared to challenge the economics of that community. He had helped a young woman who was being exploited, and the powers that be didn't like it because it kind of got into their money train. So he goes on over to Athens. When he hits town, he looks around, and he's disturbed because he sees all of these idols. Everywhere there's an idol. He talks to the Jews first, as was his custom, and then he talked to the others who had invited him to the Areopagus. That's the kind of where, the place where you just could air any grievance, any thought, investigation of issues, just a public forum. And he was invited to come there. And Paul says, "I don't understand why you all have all these idols, but there's one to the unknown God. And we worship this unknown God. This God who created all things, this God who established the boundaries of humankind, this God who is majestic and powerful, this God is whom we worship." Now, these folks in Athens gathered regularly because they wanted to hear something new. They delighted in news. And so that was another reason, and maybe the main reason, that they invited Paul, because he was talking something they hadn't heard about before, about Jesus, the risen one. Now, they had talked a whole lot about resurrection because a lot of their great leaders and their gods, they believe, had been resurrected. But there was something different about Jesus, who was risen. And Paul talked to them about it. We don't have much detail about that conversation, but you will hear much about it as you continue to read the Bible, and particularly as you read the new book, the next book of Corinth, because that was his next stop over in Corinth. Seems to me that we need to focus on the fact that it was a case of almost new. To dabble in newness does not necessarily mean that you discover what is new. We live in a country, in a time, and I don't know that this is all so much different than it's ever been, because we have always liked something new, a new way of doing things. a new way of looking at things, a new way of convenience. I particularly must confess to that yoke. It's so nice to have some new doodad. It's so nice to be able to look at a computer, even though you can't make it work all the time and make it obey some of the time. It's so nice to get a new car and learn its ins and outs. I guess it's nice to get new clothes. I don't get as much excitement about that as Ramona does, but shoes, I don't know. Why do I need new shoes? These are good for walking. But anyhow, we like stuff that's new. We like stuff that's new. And this is a thing that is both our freedom and our bondage. Because in the newness of making stuff, sometimes we just let it make us anything but new. We come to rely upon it. We come to believe in it. We almost see it as efficacious for our lives, not only our comfort, but for our future. And thus the world has come to rely upon what that is new. And we can bail ourselves out of anything because something new will be developed to make that happen. And therefore we live in a time and a life and a culture of that which is almost new. I'm not one of those, they call them Ludians, I think, Ludden, something like that, who think that all of technology and development is bad. We had the privilege of living in Vandalia, Missouri, and it was a wonderful town. They had 3 brick plants there, and it was a wonderful agricultural part of that state. Prairie land that had been rescued, as it were, by fertilizer, and farmers just had bumper crops. They had a lot of water, and they had this clay that could be made into good products for steel manufacturing. A custom our church was to have Wednesday night prayer meetings. And of course, that was my privilege and sometimes task to lead. It was in that year when America was excited about going to the moon. We talked about that one Wednesday night. And Mrs. Kriegbaum wasn't real thrilled about it. She said, "I don't think we should be doing that." "Well, Miss Kriegbaum, what's your issue?" "If we go to the moon, or if we send a rocket to the moon, it's going to put it out. And it'll no longer be a globe up there that we can look at. We'll kill the moon." May I submit to you that this is not a case of too little information. It's a case of too much information. Her mind was full. And there was no space for anything new. She had established the bounds very carefully of her framework. Often wondered about Elmer. He's kind of a little fellow. His hands were so stained from smoking cigarettes. And you didn't have to look at his hands. You could smell it when you got close. But Elmer was a great guy. Loved to go fishing. Never had the chance to fish with Elmer. Hear his stories. But everybody knew Mrs. Kriegbaum. A good lady, but reflective of the fact that there really is nothing new in the world. Kind of like the writer of Ecclesiastes. There's nothing new. Well, the fact is, what we proclaim and believe and long for as being new, much of it is just almost new. Until we wed our technology and our lives and our thought and our knowledge for the purpose that it's given to us, to enhance, not control, not making the world subject to who we are, but enable a better life, a better way for all people. Then it's really new. Perhaps it's also almost new when we are so caught up in the responsibilities of maintenance. May I suggest that most of us, many of us on the road of life, are maintainers. We keep the road clear, travelable. And to be able to maintain is a necessary and important and many times unheralded role that we have. To maintain sometimes is a joy and a privilege. Sometimes it's a big time burden. The thing that Paul noticed in Athens, that there was a class of maintainers. They are the ones that did all the menial chores. They are the ones that did not have freedom. They were the ones that perpetuated the power elite, although nobody would ever agree that that was the case. Perhaps you remember the story of Fannie Lou Hamer. She was one of 20 children. Without her consent, she was sterilized. In 1963, returning from Charleston, South Carolina, with other activists who had attended a literacy workshop, she was stopped in Winona, Mississippi. They were arrested on false charges. She was jailed. She and her colleagues were beaten and ravaged by the police, almost to the point of death. Whenever she had a chance to speak about her experiences and lead groups of protest, she would say, "All my life, I've been sick and tired. Now I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired." Sometimes the maintainers have to rise up. And there is a feeling abroad that America is with an elite and a huge group of maintainers. Well, it's wonderful, though, to catch the fact of Jesus, who came to be a servant. And as a servant, he was willing to take the low spot. As a servant, he was willing to give his life for the world. As a servant, he taught all of us what it means to find a life abundant in giving ourselves away. We sang it last Sunday. "I am the light of the world. You people come and follow me. If you follow and love, you'll learn the mystery of what you were meant to do and to be." The thing is that the risen Christ, as I understand just a little of what this means, is God within us. and the mind, reflecting upon everything that's around us, asking not always the convenient questions, but often the hard questions, is not separated, but is bonded together by a presence of love, life, and hope. Then it's not almost new. It is new. Behold, Jesus said, I make all things new. The writer of Lamentations says, thy promises are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. And consequently, because of this wonderful truth and this felt reality, it's not almost new. It's new. Real new. Lord, what an hour spent in your presence will prevail to make. What heavy burdens from our soul hearts take. What parched grounds refresh as with a shower. We kneel, how weak. We rise, how full of power. Everything? That's what the poet says. We might argue with him. Everything stands out in clear and outline, brave and true. So why should we ever do ourselves this wrong or others, that we should ever weak or heartless be, when with us is prayer and joy and strength and courage are with thee? We gather here to pray, to learn, to discover, to help bring to birth that which is new through the power and grace of the Holy Spirit. And indeed, this is a sweet, sweet place.